the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, and this morning, Katie Mullally and I explore a new invention. It's the world's first digestible diapers, that is, digested by fungi and designed to break down in a landfill thanks to new fungi-powered decomposition technology. And then we speak with theoretical physicist and science writer Catherine Zurich from the California Institute of Technology. She joins us to talk about the mysteries of dark matter. It's all in a recent article that she wrote on the topic in Scientific American magazine this month. And she's really speaks about it in a way that you can understand. So, theoretical physicist enthusiasts, stay tuned. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Every year, over 18 billion diapers are discarded into U.S. landfills. Each one destined to sit for somewhere around 500 years. In the meantime, leaking microplastics and chemicals into our soil and water. Now, there are diapers, for example, that are made of compostable materials, more eco-friendly, like bamboo diapers. But a new company is offering a radically hopeful path forward, powered by what they call the planet's oldest cleanup crew. Fungi. Joining us to tell us more are Taro Isocopula and Mickey Agrawal from Hero Technologies. It's a company that has created the new technology behind fungi-powered diapers, digestible diapers. Taro and Mickey, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
As any parent knows, this is such a huge question. Do I do cloth diapers? Do I do plastic diapers? And we know that diapers in general aren't eco-friendly. As I mentioned in the intro, there are some new compostable type diapers that won't sit in the landfill for 500 years, but more around a couple of months. But your technology, and Tara, why don't we start with you, is about having fungi eating these diapers. Wow, what a concept. Tell us more.
Yeah, this is Mickey's vision to bring this product to life, but let me touch upon that problem a bit. So diapers have existed roughly since the 60s and heavily for the last 40, 50 years. And every year we create enough disposable diapers to eat about 250 million barrels of crude oil. And what's even sadder is not the 250 million barrels of crude oil, but it's that every disposable diaper ever created is still in a landfill today. Even the eco diapers have to use a plastic called SAP in them. So even if they replace some of the polyethylene and polypropylene, this is a science show, so we went straight to the science. Even if they replace it with a corn paste, kind of bioplastics like PLA, the core of the diaper, the absorbent part that absorbs many times its weight in water, is called SAP. It's a sodium-based plastic. And
it just stands for super absorbent polymer.
Yes. That just means every diaper ever created is in a landfill. And we every year we create so many more. And there's no end-of-life solution for them. And in plastic in general, about 9% is recycled. So in general, for the single-use plastics of today, there is no real scalable solution, and recycling doesn't really address it. But I'll let Mickey comment on the vision that she had with her son Hero on bringing it to diapers first.
The idea of just changing diapers and diapers and diapers is, you know, as both Tara and I are both parents, and going through just that when you lift the bag out of the diaper pail and bring it to the trash can, like several times a week, it's just, and to know that those giant diapers end up in a landfill, and finally researching it, really seeing the massive scale, the number of diapers that end up in a landfill every year could circle the earth 33 times. I mean, these stats are wild when you really think about it. this whole vision that kind of came to was, you know, one day just literally staring out the window looking at trees, there's sort of this vision hit where it was like, wait a minute, breast milk is considered liquid gold, and therefore baby poop must be fertilizer gold. And right now we're just wrapping this potent fertilizer mama juju, you know, like magic juice, and wrapping in plastic and throwing it away in the trash. And when you think about we're using pig poop and cow poop to fertilize our food and so much of our, you know, food system, and yet the thing that comes from us and it's in the most potent baby form, billions of pounds of these are just getting thrown away in a landfill and not harnessed for good. And so the question became like, what could potentially, when the baby poops into the diaper, what could the diaper be fertilized like by to then potentially eat the diaper? And as I was asking myself that question, like what could actually break down a diaper and be fertilized by baby's poop, my son Hiro, when he was 2 years old, comes running into my bedroom, points to a book in my nightstand that had no business being there. I open up this book, and cut to on page 31, it says there's certain types of fungi that can break down plastics. As I was asking myself what could break down plastics, my 2-year-old son Hiro points to this book called Pacha's Pajamas, which is Pacha means Pachamama, Mother Earth. It was just like the most divine intervention moment of my life, you know? And so then cut to, you know, a year later, moved to Austin. First friend in Austin is tarot. And he comes over to my home with his beautiful pregnant partner, and they give birth. They're going through, you know, many, many, many diapers a day. And then he calls me and like, we're in, like, we're doing this.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Taro Isikopula and Mickey Agrawal. Well, let's get to these origin stories. Taro, you have a history with mushrooms, and specifically mushrooms that we drink. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Finland at a family farm we've had at least since 1619. So me and my brother are now 13th generation managing that farm, and that farm, Finnish people too, have a long history of mushrooms. I started learning about culinary mushrooms when I was yay high, and then got into functional mushrooms, which are like culinary mushrooms, but with a rocket fuel on them. Mushrooms like lion's mane, shiitake, maitake, reishi, chaga. And at that point, not a lot of people were drinking them in the kind of modern world. And about almost 15 years ago, decided to start a company called Four Sigmatic. About 10 years ago, started the world's first mushroom coffee, which sounds obscure and weird, but it's now like a $2 billion annual thing. And then, yeah, and been building this like wellness mushroom category from nothing to somewhat meaningful size. So that's kind of my background with mushrooms. I've won two, 20 years ago, randomly also discovered a mushroom and won an innovation award for another culinary mushroom. But yeah, and then I've written a few books on mushrooms. If anybody here is interested in mushrooms for health or just general culinary side, then there's books out there in every bookstore.
Well, and Mickey, like you alluded to earlier, that your company Tushy, tell us about how you came to this. It's not just from being a mother that brought you to this business and this new endeavor. It's also your entrepreneurial background. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, my two previous companies, Tushy and Thinx, they're both kind of dealing with the, you know, the parts of our bodies that leave our bodies, whether it's, you know, periods or pee or poop, and it's something that every human being does, you know. Every woman has a period, every human being pees and poops. And so I've been sort of very curious about, you know, what are we currently doing, and can they made better? Can they be made better? You know, my whole sort of personal vision is always elevate people on the planet. Like that has always been something that I'm interested in. And can we create new ideas and new ways to elevate people on the planet through inventions, through products? And Tushy is like a modern bidet that washes your butt clean after you poop. And it's a simple attachable thing that takes 10 minutes to install. There's no plumbing or electrical required. So it's just a really, really simple thing for any American household to just plug onto their toilet, and turns any toilet into a bidet. And so this company, you know, again, blew up. We raised very little money. It's done, you know, over $250 million to date. And we have a great team in New York in place to really, you know, build this thing out. And then, you know, Thinx as well, prior to that, is really looking at the period space and challenging this old, you know, category that only had tampons, pads, and other, you know, things, bleached things that entered women's bodies, which was just so toxic and bad for us. And that these applicators and pads ended up in landfills, also taking hundreds and hundreds of years to break down. And so our, you know, created period-proof underwear that supported women and that, you know, created also this whole category that's now almost $1 billion as well. So pretty cool to kind of look at these categories and then collaborate with, you know, someone at the top of his game in Fungi and sort of come together and really try to really, really approach this global plastic crisis where 91% of plastic is not being recycled. It's being incinerated, put in landfills or our oceans, and to really harness our baby's poop and to harness fungi, you know, nature's greatest decomposers for hundreds of millions of years, and to partner with them and Taro to really work on solving global plastic crisis one baby poop at a time is just really fun.
One baby poop at a time. I love that. Oh, we could speak to you all day, Mickey, about these companies you founded. It's really incredible. And hopefully we can circle back around to it because I see more and more and more people with those attachable bidets. It's incredible how often you see them now. But let's move back into fungi and talking about mushrooms, Taro. It seems to us every time we interview a mushroom expert, I think, why don't we use this technology more? Why don't we know about it? I think people have a fair idea that mushrooms equate to health somewhere down the road. But in terms of the power of fungi, being able to eat plastic, let's talk about that. How many different types of fungi can eat plastic, Taro?
Well, right now we've identified 132 species that scientifically various groups of researchers around the world have found that they break down at least a single polymer, a single type, you know, some multiple types of polymers. So we already know that there's over 100 and we're constantly discovering new. And our team has also discovered ones that have not been researched before. So you might ask, well, why didn't I know about this before? Why didn't this exist before? And there's probably two reasons. One is that the Western world, heavily Anglo-Saxon, has been mycophobic. So there's a fear of mushrooms. Nobody knows exactly why. There are theories about, you know, from witchcraft to molds in buildings, because the molds in buildings are the bad kind of fungi, and there was a lot of moisture maybe in England or the UK. There's a lot of theories, but a lot of the rest of the world, Asian, Slavic cultures, South American cultures were much more mushroom-friendly, but Anglo-Saxons were, you know, mycophobic. So there's been fear across the board.
Okay. Can these 130 plus species of fungi, Taro, digest any type of plastic, or is there a perfect matchup with certain types of plastic? And do the diapers then have to be made of this certain type of plastic?
We don't know for sure, but we assume that the answer is yes, they can break down every type of plastic. And why I say we don't know yet is that there are a lot of different types of plastics. Even within, let's say, polyethylene or polypropylene, there's many kinds of polyethylenes, right? So it's just such a big thing to study. But in our case, the diapers are made out of between 5 to 7 polymers or these plastics. So polyethylene, polypropylene, SAP, Velcro, PET, and those cover 70% of these soft plastics that are also the hardest to break down, cover like 70% of the single-use plastics we use today. So we know it can solve a lot of this trillion-plus dollar problem.
Well, Mickey, let's talk about the logistics of actually using these diapers, because it was interesting to read that you'll have the diaper and then a little packet that goes with it. So is it something that every parent, after they change the diapers, will then little packet in with the diaper into a bag? What's the process after you take the baby's diaper off, I guess, from that getting into the landfill?
Right. It's literally one step, and we call it one inspired action. So it's literally, as you're changing the diaper, you drop a little pouch in, you close it, you throw it away like normal. That's it. You literally, it goes to the landfill and it starts breaking down in the landfill. There's nothing else to do except adding this one little pouch. We call it one inspired action that you're helping support the global plastic crisis. Every time you change your diaper, you take one inspired action, you close it, you throw it away. So literally in the trash like normal. There's nothing else that you have to do. Initially, our whole vision is our next iteration is that it'll be directly in the diaper, directly inside, you know, the bottom part of the diaper. Of course, we'll never touch the baby. It's, in fact, it's safer than the plastic, but we want to start, you know, crawl before you walk, before you run. So teach people about fungi, that it's safe, that it's supportive, you know, and step one is, version one is, as you're changing the diaper, you just drop in, you close it, throw it away. That's it.
Well, will these diapers, once they hit the landfill, do they have the potential to actually eat additional plastics that surround them? You know, specifically like the plastic bag that the garbage goes out in, or is this fungi specifically designed to eat these diapers that you're creating?
They're designed to eat the diapers they're creating, but the bigger vision is that it'll eventually break down the plastics. That's our big, hairy, audacious goal.
And why can these fungi break down plastic is actually also kind of an answer to that question. So, you know, they didn't evolve to eat plastic because plastic didn't exist before. But what they did evolve a long, long time ago is break down trees. And trees are very hard to break down. There was a time in history when we had a problem on Earth, much before our time, is that there were too many trees, which sounds crazy in today's world, right? And then these fungi learn how to break the hard-to-digest part of the tree, which is called lignin. And then these trees died or got digested, and them and dinosaurs and dead animals became oil, and that oil became plastic. And now plastics exist in nature. So there's a little friendly fungi went there and is like, oh, the carbon backbone of plastic is very similar to the carbon backbone of lignin, which we've been eating for a long time. So, you know, it's a food we know, and they learn to eat it. So what probably happens is, once they enter the landfill fungi, they will keep adjusting, and their children and great grandchildren will learn to excrete different kinds of enzymes for whatever is nutrition in that landfill. So I believe that over time that will be the case. But again, like, you got to crawl before you walk, and you got to walk before you run.
That's right. And when you actually think about it, like, you know, billions of years ago, when the Earth was formed, fungi were the first being on Earth to really learn how to digest things, right? And then like 360 million years ago is around when trees were formed. Trees kind of came with a hard carbon backbone, which is this lignin, right? But then it took fungi like 70 to 90 million years. Of course, it's, you know, still unclear how, like, it took them 70 to 90 million years to figure out how to create these enzymes to break down this carbon backbone, this lignin, this hard part of the trees. And what's really, really interesting is that, so over these years, trees just piled up like dead bodies, kind of like plastic on the planet. Trees, dead bodies, like animals, carcasses, and there was nothing that could actually break them down. So they just littered the planet. And so it took that much. So what happened was these trees and these dead animals and dead trees got compressed over the years under the ground and formed our fossil fuels, formed our oil. And so actually our oil that we're extracting to make plastic with, to gas up our cars, actually is the oil from, is compressed dead trees and animals from hundreds of millions of years ago. And so when you really think about it, what we're trying to do is we're trying to break down this plastic, which is the carbon that comes from the oil, which comes from dead trees from hundreds of millions of years ago. So fungi that have been breaking, you know, down these lignin since 290 million years ago, it's actually not a huge jump because it's all carbon. Yeah. To really break down plastic as well. So it's just now up to humanity, instead of letting plastic just go and just trash our planet like trees did a long time ago when they died, we're now here as human species to partner with nature and say, hey, can we help you break it down faster together? Can we innovate together and solve these problems together instead of waiting millions and millions and millions of years, you know, for the, you know, nature to figure it out on its own?
It sounds to me like it's inserting this missing component that brings everything full circle, and that missing component is fungi. So here's a for example. In our community of Park City, in our county, the landfill's getting filled up, and we are currently, you know, getting bids for a new cell, and it's expensive and it takes up room. And so the idea is to divert all the recyclables, everything you can from the landfill. But this concept of adding fungi into the landfill, I'd love to explore it a little bit further. So do you envision at some point taking all the plastics go in this one portion of the landfill and then introduce fungi? What's the timeline on it? And first of all, what's the timeline on the diapers being composted? And then, you know, go to the greater landfill question, Taro.
Yeah, our vision is not to be a diaper company, but instead be the global supplier of these plastic-eating fungi for multiple use cases. And by the way, we don't need to do it all ourselves. We're happy to partner with governments or other companies, consumer companies, to solve this problem. Because it's so big that no matter how well we do, it's just better to... It takes a village here, literally. We're just starting with diapers because, number one, it's the number one household plastic waste item. So that's important. And secondly, what we've seen from our own lives is that the next generation is environmentally very conscious. So, you know, the mothers and the new parents are asking themselves these fundamental questions, is like, what will the world look like when my kids grow up, right? From a collaboration point of view, we'll feel like it's fruitful versus maybe in some cases, I'm talking broadly, not individually. You know, some people feel like the problem has gone too far and there's nothing we can do and, you know, it's too late or something like that. And we don't believe that. We believe that the time is now, right? So that's why starting with diapers and hopefully providing these to landfills, for example, and, you know, skipping the diaper phase.
Well, out here in the West, we have such a problem with invasive species, things that were well intended to begin with. Let's plant the tamarisk along the riverbanks to help with erosion, and now they've spread everywhere, certain animals and other species. Does fungi have that potential to run amok, if you will, and become the next invasive species, even though it's well intentioned with eating all the plastic?
That's a great question. I feel like our team has thought a lot about this. The cool thing is that I mentioned that there's currently research on roughly 132 species out in the public. So on the public domain, you can find it yourself. A lot of these were discovered in landfills. So scientists would go to landfills today and they would say, oh, there's this little piece of plastic that's degrading. What's in it? And they found these species. So first of all, they're already there. There's just not enough of them, or they're not maybe evolved into maximizing their potential, and we're just training them to be better. The second thing is that landfills are a closed environment. So if things would leach from a landfill, an invasive species or fungi in this case, that we would have bigger problems on our hands, because that would mean that all those toxic chemicals and other things in the landfill would be leaching out too. So no, I don't think it's a concern. And I honestly think, you know, I'm not worried about the fungi. The fungi have been here a lot longer than we have, and they will be here a lot longer than we will.
But the one thing I want to add to that, which is that, like, the mycelial network lives under the entire planet. Mm-hmm. The entire planet, like, underneath the entire, is this wood wide web, which is, it already is there. And so, you know, when people say invasive, they just can't see it. There's no invasion. It's already underneath the entire planet. The fear we have is that we've just lost touch with nature. We've just lost touch with what's just touching nature. And then even like digging I don't even know how much underground. If you're like, you'll just see the mycelial network starting already. So I think ultimately it's just like reinvigorating our connection to nature, re-remembering that we're already deeply interconnected, that we actually have, Taro taught me that, we have a microbiome inside of our systems. We already have that in our bodies. There's not even just a microbiome, but a mycobiome. I think for us, it's really the reconnection to nature and saying, hey, like, we can collaborate together. The whole point of being a species on Earth and a very conscious species, the ones with a thalamus and a hypothalamus that can really think and think ahead and project, you know, we're the first species to really be able to do that. How can we harness our human genius with nature's genius and collaborate to work in and create a more harmonious environment? We absolutely can.
So how can people currently find you all and find the diapers?
Yes. I mean, I would go herodiapers.com, HIRODiapers.com. It's, you know, we just launched after 4.5 years. This is the moment where rubber meets the road, where, you know, really like eco-conscious parents who really, really care about the next generation. Like this is, you know, an inspired action that you can take to really help support the next generation is by, you know, supporting companies that are out here really trying to do our best collaborating with nature. So it'd be amazing to check out herodiapers.com, HIRODiapers.com. And then also follow us on Instagram, hero.diapers, on Instagram at hero.diapers. And what's fun about that is that we have, you know, we're telling the hero's journey story of building this. Like this is a global experiment that we're working. It's an adventure that we get to share every week. We're going to be sharing what, you know, we've discovered and what's coming up and, oh my God, discover this new species. And wow, like what's happening in our lab, what's happening with our, you know, all women, all female science team, you know, like they're all discovering really, you know, cool new ways to add enzymes, add, you know, different things. So it's a really fun journey to join and join the journey.
Well, Miki Agrawal and Taro Isocopula, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Thank you for the work that you do. It's really exciting and we will follow you.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest, Catherine Zurek, is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology. Her research focuses on the intersection of particle physics with cosmology, astrophysics, and the quantum nature of gravity. She also writes occasionally for Scientific American magazine, and this month has explored the problem with dark matter. What is the problem with dark matter? Well, everything we know about dark matter comes from measuring its gravitational pull. But gravity is the weakest of nature's forces. So we need more than gravity to unlock the secrets of the dark side, as Catherine says in her article. Well, why do we care about dark matter? Because our galaxy, the Milky Way, is immersed in dark matter. Catherine joins us now to discuss this article in Scientific American this month titled, Dark Matter Might Lurk in Its Own Shadow World. Catherine, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're really happy that you could join us to explain what, for most people, like 95% of us, would be a really complex topic. But you start off your article in a really great way using the metaphor of the ocean, which we all also find pretty overwhelming. How do you equate the two?
Well, I was actually walking the Lost Coast Trail and listening to the ocean and thinking about how immersive the ocean is, how it overwhelms us, and how also it puts us, you know, in the context of the universe with how powerful it is. And I think in some ways, the dark matter mystery does a little bit of the same thing. We literally are flowing through a sea of dark matter. Dark matter passes through us and through this room all the time as the solar system passes on its journey through the Milky Way galaxy. And so dark matter is literally all around us. And yet we still haven't cracked the mystery at all of the nature of the dark matter. It also gives us a sense of humility about how many things in the universe or in the world around us we still don't comprehend.
Yes, which is really wild in that I think it would make a lot of people, and it does, make a lot of people turn away, like it's too big, I can't think about. But someone like you who has based a big part of your career, I think you entered what you call the dark matter hunt in 2005. Why does it attract you to it instead of make you turn away? Is it because you can explain a lot of things already with what you already know with theoretical physics?
I think you have to like hard problems by nature. And over years and over decades, you learn a certain type of patience and strength to be able to sit in front of hard problems for years and decades and look at them and turn them over and not solve them. And that's a particular type of exercise, a particular type of strength that you develop by practice.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, Catherine Zurich. She's talking about her new article in Scientific American this month entitled "Dark Matter Might Lurk in Its Own Shadow World." Well, as we're talking to you, we see this blackboard behind you full of equations and what I think are numbers, but probably not. A lot of them are. They're actually symbols. But when you talk about this search for dark matter or anything in this theoretical realm, you know, I think most of us want to imagine that you actually find something like a particle actually lands, you know, thinking like geology or chemistry where they find tangible objects. But I don't think a lot of you do, do you? How do you conduct this research to create data out of what seems like to most of us is very, very, very tiny, if not nothing?
It is true we do not capture and keep dark matter.
But it's all in us anyway. So like you said earlier,
it's all passing through us at about 10 to the minus 3, about one part in 1,000 times the speed of light. So it moves through us, it passes through us. So what we're trying to do in the types of laboratory experiments that I've proposed is to detect interactions of those particles as they pass through us. So we, of course, have experience of this every day for ordinary forces and ordinary matter. Right, we get light from the sun. That's an interaction. It interacts with the atoms in our eyes, and that's how we see things. It just turns out to be the case that dark matter has just very, very weak interactions with us, and so we have to work very hard to look for direct signs of individual dark matter particles so that we can learn something about it.
In the article, you were saying that in the past, dark matter, the search for dark matter was only focused on one particle, but now you're all rethinking that. What was that particle and what are you going to expand the search into?
So these particles were called weakly interacting massive particles, which has the acronym of a WIMP. So physicists, particle physicists have a sense of humor. So we talk, when we're talking about dark matter, we throw around the word WIMP all the time. So this dark matter particle, I call it parasitic. And the reason why it's parasitic is because it was postulated to solve some problems with the weak force that, you know, mediates, for example, nuclear interactions. So it's parasitic in the sense that its interactions depend on a known force of the, what we call the standard model of particle physics. So in one way, that's really nice because the interactions are predictive because it's a force that we know about. And so it's still very hard to look for because the weak interaction is weak. But for the last approximately 30 years, a little bit more, experimentalists have built these exquisite experiments to look for these very weak interactions of WIMPs. And it's turned out that those searches have turned up nothing. No sign of dark matter. That has, I would say, catalyzed or focused the attention of the field in new directions because we know dark matter is there. The Milky Way galaxy wouldn't form the way it is if there wasn't dark matter. There's so many signs. We know that there is dark matter from the way it interacts, from the way that the universe formed. And so we've had to broaden the scope. We've had to put aside our prejudices and think about new theories of dark matter. And so that is what I started working on actually all the way back in 2005. Really before the crisis, the dark matter crisis or the WIMP crisis, I think, went into full swing.
I do love the WIMP acronym. It's an easy one to remember. And I think everyone needs to know that theoretical physicists have a sense of humor. This is good. I wanted to ask you about the different forces. You know, we said in the intro that gravity is actually a weak force. Electromagnetism is a bigger force. Can you talk about the different forces and how they interact with dark matter, how they, in our galaxy, in the Milky Way, how it keeps us from imploding, the different forces?
So in the standard model of particle physics, which is quantum in nature, there are three forces. There is the electromagnetic force. So for example, light mediates that force. There is the weak force, which causes nuclear reactions. And then there's the strong force, and the strong force holds nuclei together. So it holds quarks and puts them into protons and neutrons. So those are the three quantum forces, and we have exquisite quantum description of those forces. And then there's a fourth force, which is gravity. And gravity is the weakest of all the forces. We don't currently have a quantum description for gravity. But nevertheless, to describe what we see, we don't need a quantum description. The classical theory is sufficient. But what happens is to describe is that gravity holds galaxies together. So we know that galaxies like the Milky Way galaxies, the stars in it and the planets don't sit still. We run around the center of the galaxy at actually a very high speed. It's a couple hundred kilometers per second, very high speed. And you know that when something goes quickly in a circle, it'll just fly off unless there's a force to keep it in. And the force that keeps it in is mostly provided by dark matter. We couldn't explain the way that matter moves in our galaxy without dark matter. And so we, by looking at, so this is just one example of where we need dark matter in order to explain the universe as we see it. Without dark matter, quite literally, life could not come to form as we know it. It really is that important. But in order to learn about something more about dark matter, we need kind of more microscopic information. So sometimes an analogy that I make is like, if you just had a box, like there was some big crate and you just picked it up and weighed it, you learn something about, you know, how much that box weighs, which is through gravity, but you don't know anything about what's inside, right? You don't know what the not only what the materials are, but even at a more basic level, what are the forces? What are the different particles? How are they structured? We don't know any of those things. And that's really the situation we're in with dark matter.
That's great. That is a great explanation. So once you find in your hunt for dark matter, something that is able to detect or to explain it better, what's the biggest question that you think that will answer for you, for humanity, for our universe?
It's just a big question mark as to what is the substance? You know, like I think by human nature, you know, if you saw there was a whole mass of things that you couldn't explain with all the forces that you've explored so far, like you would just want to have some idea, like, what is it? What's the mass of the particle? What kind of interactions does it have? Does it form, you know, nuclei of its own? Does it have its own kinds of forces? How was it, did it come to be to have that much of it? It's, I think just by human nature, you just want to learn something about it. And so I think a lot of what drives what we do is just trying to understand what our universe is like and what it's made of. And dark matter is 5 times more prevalent in our universe than, you know, protons, neutrons, electrons, photons, neutrinos, all the things we know about. It's 5 times more prevalent. And yet we don't know what it is.
Catherine, earlier you were talking about the standard model, and in reading the article, all of the detection models have been using the standard model. But you propose the Hidden Valley. I love it when you say that there is a hidden world of cosmology running parallel to our own. Tell us more about this new method of detecting dark matter that you're proposing.
Yeah, so we started out talking about how we live in the sea, but the sea passes through us. So it, in that sense, it literally runs parallel, because normally we don't interact with it. I mean, we don't sense it just in our day-to-day lives. We have to have these extremely sensitive instruments to detect rare whispers from the dark sector. And so there are some things we can say about this parallel world just by, you know, the way the Milky Way galaxy forms, but really not a whole lot. And so it's that's what we're really trying to do, is to probe into that hidden world, that parallel universe, and understand what's in it. And so to do that, what we're doing is to build just very, very sensitive interactions, looking for very faint whispers from that other sector, and then to slowly start to build up from those first whispers what might be in that dark sector. It sounds a little bit like science fiction.
Or Harry Potter.
I assure you, it is all quantitative. You know, we make exquisite measurements.
And really great acronyms. Well, we always love to talk to people about the collaborations with other groups, people, disciplines. And I think a lot of us just assume that all you physicists speak the same language. But I really enjoyed the part where you're talking about how you're a dark matter physicist, and when you were collaborating with condensed matter physicists, you had to find a common jargon. What is the difference between the jargon that you're using, and how are you both so different in general?
It's a remarkable thing. Physicists have cultures. And not just physics has a culture, but subfields of physics have cultures. They have questions that they as a field, we as fields, subfields of physics, we become interested in them. And we develop a language around the questions that we're interested in. And that language is often called jargon. And we define mathematical quantities to answer those questions. And so different subfields get interested in those questions, and they become a little bit like superhighways. You know, there's a language that's developed. People who are in the field know that language. They all talk to each other. They know what each other means, and they're trying to solve that problem. And one of the interesting things about coming from another field is you really notice this. How much a field is interested in a certain question, and how, even if you're interested in a question that's just a little bit adjacent to it, that it can be very hard to get the answer. Because we develop these cultures and pursue, you know, particular questions. And so in order to try to expand, you know, if you enter into a new subfield and you need like an answer, like I needed an answer from condensed matter physics, I need to be able to talk to them in their language about the things that they know and how that's just a little bit adjacent to what I need to know. And to do that, I have to learn the language. I have to understand what questions they're interested in. And then I have to learn the language that they use to describe those systems. And that is one of the first things that you have to do when you're approaching a different field. So I've had now experience with this in more than one area, but I found that once you understand how they frame questions and you can use some of that language to ask the parallel question, you really can make progress a lot faster. So I've learned about cultures and physics and how that impacts the questions that we ask and how important language is to being able to ask and answer questions.
That's a good metaphor for how we all might be able to understand each other better and realize that we need to learn some different languages and different lexicon to have that come from that other people do. have.
Scientists are human too, and we have cultures and language that we use when we're doing science.
So in your Scientific American article about dark matter, talking about how it may be a whole shadow world of mysterious atoms and forces, and it reminded me of an article that I saw kind of recently about photos from the James Webb Space Telescope discovering that perhaps our entire universe is in a black hole. And it made me wonder what someone like, I know, it made me wonder what someone like you, in your work, what you learn from things like James Webb Space Telescope. Is there anything applicable there that kind of helps you along your route, as you know, to a certain degree, like those, all those formulas on the blackboard behind you?
Yeah, so the James Webb is a telescope that's going to give us more information about how, and I keep using this word, structures like galaxies, how they form and evolve in our universe. And all of that information, because the dynamics of galaxies can't be understood without dark matter, all of that helps us to better understand our universe as it is, and therefore to learn more about what dark matter is. So it is absolutely another, those observations of the universe, especially when the universe was very young, do help us to get more information about how dark matter plays its role in the universe as we see it.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. In your work, it's interesting to me because when we speak to science journalists, oftentimes who write for Scientific American, that's what they do. And you're a theoretical physicist by day and a science writer sort of by in your spare time. And I'm wondering what your motivation is for that. You know, does it help to keep you in touch with what the greater population thinks about? I don't know. I'm just kind of curious because you're a great writer and it's very interesting.
I think it was just an opportunity to exercise a different part of my brain. And to think about what I'm doing in a broader context and to talk a little bit about the human side of what we do, what motivates me, how scientists think about doing science, you know, the particular example of it, and how it fits into, you know, the broader context of our humanity.
Yeah, interesting. And then just to wrap here, but wondering if you enjoy talking about what you do, if there are certain ways that you explain, say when you're at a dinner party or something like that, to non-scientists, is that something that you're entertained by or not really?
Well, I'm entertained about talking about the science that I do.
Yeah, and just kind of explaining it in a way that hopefully, like we try to do here on Cool Science Radio, is make people curious about science by explaining it in a way that is understandable.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are intimidated by science or the impressions of science. And so I think science conversations come up less frequently than I would like them to. And sometimes the analogies or the don't always come most readily to mind. And so it can be hard just in the heat of the moment to explain why it is we do what we do, why it's important, how it bears on people's lives and our humanity more generally, you know, in just the context of a 5-minute conversation. Here we're having a 20, you know, something minute conversation and just barely scratching on the surface of it. And so it's something that I'm trying to learn how to do also to tap into the human side of it, of why science is important.
Oh, Catherine, I was reading in this article that
the researchers are, they want to work deep underground with their detection systems. Well, I have to say, we've got plenty of mine tunnels in this area that have actually been used in the past for particle physics detection. So anytime you need to come out and do a little tour of very, very deep spaces, let us know.
Yeah, that's right. Well, at the moment, they're excavating a cavern in Homestake, South Dakota, to build deep underground science laboratory. To house a number of these experiments that need to be put in these very quiet environments. So yes, that's one of the key elements of doing this kind of science, is to find where you can host these you know, very clean experiments in very dirty mines, deep underground. So it's one of the challenges, technical challenges of doing this kind of science.
Yeah, we read about Homestake, and I think it was a former gold mine. Is that right?
Don't quote me on that.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're a former silver mining town, so if there's something more attractive about a silver mine tunnel, it's all so interesting. So Catherine Zurich is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, and she has joined us today to talk about her article in Scientific American this month about dark matter and how it might lurk in its own shadow world. It's been really fascinating talking to you, Catherine. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City